This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
All right. Good evening, everybody. So welcome to the Mini Medical School. My name is Anthony Luke. I have the pleasure of being your course chair for this sports medicine series, as well as being your lecturer tonight. So hopefully we're going to cover a lot of interesting things in overuse injuries, which is hopefully a topic that you'll find very interesting. And I think at your next dinner party, you're going to be able to diagnose all your friends and such. So just a little bit about myself. I'm Canadian, and I am a primary care sports medicine physician, so family practice and sports medicine training. I had the honor of going to the Vancouver Olympics, so I don't know how many people have been watching the Olympics so far and enjoying things. Excellent, excellent. And, you know, certainly an interesting thing taking care of elite athletes, but, you know, they're just people as well. You know, some of these injuries that you guys get, the same things they get, just different settings sometimes. Let's show you one of these injuries here. Everyone likes a crazy fall, you know, certainly something that, you know, alarming. This is an acute injury, right? Not an overuse injury. How about this, though? Nasty break there. You know, all over ESPN when you see something like that. But this kind of an injury, you see this as maybe an acute injury, but this is an elite soccer player. His bone just doesn't break so easily. A lot of times this is an overuse injury that now becomes an acute problem. This could be a stress fracture that's underlying. He just gets hit in the right way. The leg snaps. So overuse injuries is something that, fortunately, you guys are here at Mini Medical School to learn all of this. It's something that we don't do a great job at covering for our own students because it's a complex thing. So I'm going to actually go over an approach to overuse injuries for you guys, and we're going to talk about these five areas: the mechanism of injury and pain. So if you see your friend, they're telling you their elbow hurts, you're going to ask them about, you know, how did that happen? How does that actually give you symptoms? We're going to talk about the location. I'm going to tell you how you can use that to make your diagnosis. And then we're going to talk about the type of tissues. Every tissue in the musculoskeletal system can get an overuse type injury. And we'll talk about those. You've heard about them, bursitis, tendonitis, all these kind of things. We're going to clarify all that stuff. And then finally, well, how do we fix these things? It comes down to the bottom two. A lot of it's about identifying the risk factors. You know, you might play tennis and all of a sudden your elbow's hurting, but your competitor's elbow is not. But you guys are playing the exact same amount. Well, why do you get it and maybe not the other guy? Maybe it's how you hit your forehand, how much tennis you play. There's so many little risk factors that as a sports docs, that's kind of what I like to look at. And then finally, how do you fix these things? A lot of the overuse injuries are going to be education and modifications to what you do every day. So let's just dive right in. How many people know what an overuse injury is? Like, what am I talking about? Okay, good. Well, let's see if you've got the right definition. This is what we have put in a recent publication that we put out. It's an injury that occurs from repetitive submaximal loading of the musculoskeletal system when rest is not adequate to allow for structural adaptation to take place. So let's break that down a little bit. That's a long definition. You know, you don't want to memorize that one. But what are the key features? Repetitive loading, doing something over and over and over. That's the overuse thing. It's not always a traumatic injury. So like when you're talking to people and we're starting with talking about mechanisms here, you know, a lot of people are like, you didn't get it. You didn't fall. That's not really an injury. But the knee hurts. You know, it might be another type of mechanism. And then it's got to overwhelm the ability of the tissue to remodel. And that leads it to get damaged. So it's this cumulative damage that gets on this. And we're going to go into different tissue types to explain, like, how does arthritis come about? How does a tendon problem come about? But just think about it like, you know, you go to the gym, you lift weights. You don't get sore every time. But if I gave you a barbell and told you to lift something too heavy 50 times, 100 times? You know, how long will it take before it just overwhelms what that tissue is able to do and now you get an injury? You know, maybe it's you're tired. That might be the thing that tips it over to getting injured. And so there's always this imbalance between your training loads and recovery. Because just like you go to the gym, you work out, you get sore. Then you go home, maybe it's sore for a couple days, you're getting better. You go back and now you're even stronger, you can lift more. That's how the musculoskeletal systems work. It adapts to different loads. But just say you kept lifting too much, or just say if you're a runner, you start running a little too much and you don't give yourself time to recover in between. Now you're overloading that system so that it's now not able to take that, and then eventually you can't recover, and now it cumulatively adds up until now you start feeling it. So I always get the question, you know, why did I get an injury? It's a simple answer for me. It's always some combination of too much, too hard, too fast for these overuse injuries. It's not like somebody kind of ran over you on a bike or something like that. This is, you know, these things may not be so clear to people when you ask them, hey, well, how did that come out? Like, why'd you get injured? They're like, I don't know why I got injured. You know, I've been running 20 years and now my knee hurts. Well, now that's where you got to look into it. It's like a detective story. Is it too much, too hard, too fast? What exactly is it? And it's for that individual, for that person. And we're going to get into that when we talk about risk factors. And then so like when you think too much, too hard, too fast, just go back to physics. We liked physics when they were in high school and such. So what's Newton's law number one? Anyone remember that one? Okay, I think I heard it. An object in motion stays in motion unless an external force stops it. So what are those external forces that work against you when you're trying to exercise? It could be resistance. It could be wind, the road, running up a hill. Like there are different forces that get applied to your body, which is moving and slowing you down. And that leads to stress. Sometimes, again, we talked about fatigue, that it's just harder to do something as you get tired. That leads to more stress in the body. So Newton's law number two, anyone? All right. Force equals mass times acceleration, remember? So, you know, just if you're heavier, you know, Thanksgiving just went by, you're a runner, put on 10 pounds, you go for the same run, that means your knee's seeing more weight on that stress to the knee. You know, if people, they do that, they go up the stairs. It's 3 times body weight when you climb stairs. It's 6 times body weight when you go into a full squat. So it's not a wonder why, okay, your knee's a little achy. Those are the kind of things that bother you. It's force equals mass times acceleration. Or it's like, hey, I'm feeling really awesome today. I'm going to run twice as fast. You know, that's acceleration. So again, it's a simple formula. So again, when you're looking at, well, your friend's telling you, oh, I got these running injuries. Well, what'd you do? Oh, I doubled my mileage. Oh, I went interval training on the track. I went out to Kezar and went sprinting. I felt good. That's maybe not something they normally do. And then, of course, Newton's law number 3, every force has an equal and opposite force. And so this is just like a diagram, somebody jumping down. But when you hit the ground will hit you back with the exact same amount of force. So again, you think about the marathon runner and just repetitive overuse loading. You're just going to keep pounding on it. You know, just say I make you run on the sidewalk, which is harder than asphalt or harder than grass, and you just start increasing this thing. So again, think about it. It all goes back to physics. You can probably deduce why this person's getting problems. All right, let's go to the second concept that I want to talk about in terms of our approach to an overuse injury. So the location. And so you've got your friend. He's telling you about his problem. You know, where does it hurt? Oh, it's all over this. Not that helpful, right? Where does it hurt the most? Get them to point to it. It's right on my elbow, right on this spot. I'm starting to think tennis elbow. It's right on the front of my knee, underneath my kneecap. You start thinking patellar tendon. You know, it's right on the inside part of the knee, maybe some arthritis. They're very specific things. Just think about what's in that location, but make them commit to, oh, it's right here. Then you start thinking about the tissues in that location. How many people in here have had Achilles problems? Okay, so that's around the right stats, maybe around 20% of you. So let's talk about the simple act of walking and running. You know, when you step down on your heel, you're going to go into what we call mid-stance. And if you remember what's on the bottom of your foot, that's where the plantar fascia is. So the body's very created in a really interesting and cool way. It stores kinetic energy. These things are like elastic bands. Your Achilles tendon and your plantar fascia. As you load it, it kind of stretches and it retains a lot of this kinetic energy so that when you toe off, these things coil back like an elastic band and propel you off. So if you imagine you're flattening out the foot, that's why sometimes your foot rolls, and then when you toe off, it'll spring you off. Just like you look at a rabbit. Why can a rabbit jump so high? They don't have big calf muscles like we do, but they can probably jump as high as we can. It's probably, again, because the structure of the leg is in such a way that these tendons are so elasticy that it can make you do stuff. So it's a really interesting mechanism that helps you walk. Like, you don't think about toeing off. It's just natural. You do these things, the kinetic energy goes, and it makes us more efficient. And it's one of the reasons why we can run on 2 feet. Now, how does this process become a problem? Well, we're going to do what we call repetitive eccentric load on the tendon. So if you kept doing that over and over and over, and it's overwhelming that tendon to be able to do that, now you're going to run into problems. So eccentric loading is a really important mechanism for why we get tendon problems. So if you like to work out of the gym, you can do biceps contractions, right? The classic exercise. So when I bend my elbow, I'm doing a concentric contraction. That means that the muscle and the tendon are shortening, and that's what's happening when I do that contraction. Now, when I lower the arm, it's not like my bicep's not working anymore. It's still contracting. It's now lengthening. And that's called the eccentric contraction. So I'm doing that, otherwise my arm would just straighten out like all of a sudden. It's actually controlling it. So muscles are very interesting. They always work in pairs. My triceps and my biceps are working all at the same time to balance each other. So maybe my biceps is working concentrically, and the triceps is working eccentrically. But as I'm lowering it, and this thing's lengthening, that's an eccentric load. And that's a really important thing because that's when tendons often bother you. You know, if this thing were to rupture, it might be I'm carrying something really heavy and then all of a sudden it drops and it gets extended all of a sudden while I'm trying to contract it. It's stretching it while the muscle's shortening. So you get forces in other directions. That's a very high load. Think about it when you pull your hamstring or something. It's not like running up and down, like walking on flat ground. It's usually going to be I'm sprinting and the leg's in a weird position and it goes. Same thing with the Achilles. So how do these people present? Like, you know, 20% of you guys raised your hand that I've had Achilles problem. Like, oftentimes you just get sore on the tendon. Sometimes there might be some swelling if there's some tissue damage or some inflammation that's occurring on that. And then it hurts when you kind of use that muscle. So when you toe off, we talked about how that Achilles gets used when you toe off. That's when people usually say it hurts. And then you might passively stretch somebody, like stretch that calf and Achilles, and that's also bothering you. So you think about tendons. Like, just to give you guys a bit of background about tendons, tendons attach to muscle, like from muscle to bone, so that when the muscle contracts, it pulls the joint and moves you. So it's a little bit like an elastic band. But if you use the elastic band too much, you might get problems. You can even break the elastic band. So what are the risk factors when you get Achilles tendon problems? If this thing's like an elastic band, what happens if I have a really tight elastic band and I'm going to pull at this thing repetitively? I got to pull pretty hard sometimes if it's too tight to make myself work. So a tight calf or Achilles and a tight plantar fascia might not be so efficient for that person to toe off. We talked about it's affecting the foot shape's going to affect that, right? As you go flat, if you have a flatter foot, it's going to stretch the plantar fascia more. There might be an imbalance if that's too flat of a foot. The opposite, what if you have a high-arched foot? And if anyone's had a high-arched foot or you see some ballerinas, they have a very pretty-looking foot, but the thing doesn't actually roll at all. It's very tight. So again, that might require more activity of the Achilles tendon. Unfortunately, tendons over time don't do well. They do degenerate a little bit. So as age goes up, we get tighter, and then tendons have less capability to heal. If you're overweight, we said force equals mass times acceleration. Heavier people are going to have to push off harder. That's going to be a problem. Just wearing the wrong shoes and things like that. You know, in some ways, wearing high heels for women is a good thing. It actually protects you from needing to toe off too much. But again, that's not how your foot was designed to me, for the ladies in the audience. It's not, you know, how the foot was designed. So again, maybe sometimes people don't use the foot at all. Then they go run in flat shoes. That could be a problem. And then I'm going to highlight this stuff a lot. Well, as we talk about injuries, hip strength and core strength is really important, all the way down to the Achilles tendon. Like, you may not think about that, but if you have that injury and you go to the physical therapist and they start giving you all these core exercises, you know, no, it's my foot that's hurting. But that's a really important thing, because the core is the central part for stability for the limbs. So we can always talk about that more in question and answer periods. And so when you think about plantar fasciitis, anyone have heat pain? Where would be the location that you put for plantar fasciitis? If you're pointing with one finger, where are people going to point? I see them. People, yeah, exactly. Right on the heel. Right where you, the center of that heel. That's where people get plantar fasciitis. So you can already make that diagnosis. Look at the risk factors. Almost the exact same things as Achilles. Because they work together, right? It's not uncommon to get someone with plantar fasciitis and Achilles problems. So, now what's really going on a cellular level? Like, you know, these things can be super frustrating, right? I can't really rest you unless I'm going to put you in a boot and make you walk around on crutches. You got to walk around. So, like, you can't really rest this thing. But this could take weeks, if not months, to get better. So why is this such a resistant problem? Like, a lot of you guys probably experienced this. It's like, oh, I rested 2 weeks. I took 2 weeks off my workouts, and I went back, and it's still there. Well, why? Let's go down to use a microscope and look at this tendon. What's happening on the left is the normal tissue, like normal tendon fibrils. It's linear like a cable. If you imagine, it's got these fibers all lined up so it can take a lot of stress. Like, think about a steel cable or something like that. You want to line your cables up so it's really strong. But what happens with damage? You start getting the things on the right. If you tear some of these cables, what happens to your body? Like, when you cut your hand, what happens to this cut? It's going to scar over. Same thing that happens in tendon. So now you get scar tissue. And so this stuff isn't nice and linear. It's kind of all over the place. So remember, we talked about how tendons work like little rubber bands. If this doesn't stretch that well, it's going to be a problem, right? Especially if you start going back to repetitive activities. So that's why a lot of these people, you know, the injury doesn't usually happen when you just start getting pain. It's probably, again, an overuse injury that's been going on for some time. You're building up scar tissue and things like that. For those of you who have had chronic Achilles problems, you'll feel that the tendon is thick. There's almost a lump in there, and that's the tender spot. That's a lump of scar tissue. So I give people the analogy that it's like a rubber band, and you just put some crazy glue in the middle of it, and now you're going to keep stretching this thing. It doesn't move that well in that location. That's why people keep getting recurrent problems. And it's going to take a while for that person to get better. Now, we just started with the first thing that we want to look at in the approach for overuse injuries is talking about the mechanics. So where do tendons have problems? Usually around joints that have a lot of movement. What do you think are joints that have a lot of movement? Shoulder, exactly. Super. How many people have shoulder problems? Maybe some people aren't raising their arm because it hurts too much. What's another one that moves a lot? Knees, elbows, ankles, hips. Everything moves, huh? So that's why we get tendon problems all over the place. But especially if it crosses two joints. Some people have pain in the groin, the hip flexor. Super common like problem for the hip. The knee, the patellar tendon, there's that ropey thing right underneath your kneecap. And we talked about Achilles and plantar fascia. And then the number one on at the elbow, tennis elbow, right? Lateral epicondylosis. So what's actually going on with this thing? Sometimes it's eccentric overload. We talked about that. Sometimes it's just straight out impingement. Like for those of you with shoulder problems, rotator cuff problems, super common. Like I think if you have shoulder problems, you know, if you just said, yeah, I have shoulder problems, if I say rotator cuff, I'm probably going to be right 90% of the time. What's happening is when you get into an overhead position, the tendon that's right on the side of the shoulder gets pinched between your shoulder blade and the actual shoulder itself. So you get a pinching mechanism, and that starts getting irritation and degeneration. And then some people start thinking about temperature breakdown. That it's interesting, like we've done some science where like even some of the surgeons were trying to treat tendon problems by heating them up and scarring them over. They'd find that you start using a temperature probe and heating things up to around 55 degrees, it actually denatures the collagen, and then you could actually make tissues shrink down. The only problem was the heat's probably also killing these tendons. So we found out years later that it wasn't a good move in some cases. But like with a lot of activity, it's not uncommon for an athlete or a runner to actually heat these tendons up. And you might start getting a little bit of early breakdown into things. And then there's been a lot of science about as these things are trying to heal, as you try to fix scar tissue, that blood vessels come in, and blood vessels come with nerves, so that might be why tendon scar tissue hurts so much. Well, let's talk about little basics on treatment. You know, it hurts, you know, common sense. What would you tell your friend at the dinner party? Probably why don't you just give it a rest, like take it easy for a couple weeks, or more now that you know that it takes maybe a little longer. So modifying your activities, if something's inflamed, a little swollen, icing it makes a lot of sense. And then calf stretches. We talked about it being an elastic band. If we don't stretch this thing, it doesn't adapt. Remember that thing we talked about for mechanism? Tissues adapt. So putting it in a cast might be okay if you're so painful you can't get out of bed. But you don't want to be in that boot all day. Otherwise, when you come out, you're going to be weaker, it's going to be tighter, and then you're going to run into even more problems. So we actually have to rehab it. So the exercises and the stretches and the strengthening exercises are all extremely crucial for getting tendon problems to get better. So what else do we do? For those of you who have had Achilles problems, we want to rest it even more. We talked about being in a heel lift. You don't have to push off as much. We're going to rest it for you. Maybe not a cast, just a little heel lift. Custom orthotics, maybe you have that flat foot or too high of an arch. Maybe we got to make some adaptations to your footwear. Night splints, that's something where it's kind of like either like this little boot or sometimes a sock that we actually make you wear at night, and it stretches your foot up all night. So it's stretching that tendon while you're sleeping. So that's another way we can get a little bit of stretch on that elastic band. And then, as we mentioned before, physical therapy or rehab exercises, extremely crucial for that problem. Rarely for Achilles problems do we ever have to do surgery. And just going through the research, since we are in many medical schools, we got to throw some numbers and confuse you guys a little bit. They studied that as early as the late 90s, these eccentric exercises, training the body carefully to do stuff. Like a lot of people, don't do anything for a while and then you're going to be fine. That might work in some mild cases, but then when you go back, what do people do? They just do what they used to do. If you ran that long distance, you didn't ramp up, problem's going to come back. So this kind of study is just what we call a randomized control trial. We take people, we separate them by chance into two groups. We just see if something works or not. And what these researchers found, that they found that these eccentric exercises actually help these people more than just normal strengthening things. So we talked about eccentric loading. So if we think the Achilles problem's the problem, how are we going to eccentrically load it? If you remember, the concentric contraction makes them go on their toe. So we're going to do the opposite now. We're going to make them drop suddenly off the step. So we're going to get a stretching of that muscle tendon unit, as well as the plantar fascia, and it's lengthening. Does that make sense in terms of the... Because you're going to be able to figure this stuff out. In the question and answer, we can even test you guys out to see if you guys understood the concepts. But like, you can now figure out how you're going to fix tennis elbow if I give you enough info. But that's the kind of thing. Like, it's counterintuitive, right? That's the mechanism that hurts. Why are we doing it? Because we need to train that person to be able to tolerate these loads. Otherwise, they'll never be able to get doing what they want. Because these loads is what hurt them in the first place. So not doing anything, not doing any rehab, is not a good thing. We need to rehab these people. Let's just go into some medical terminology. Because, like, you know, that's so important. Communication is real important. This is just... This is sprechen Sie Deutsch, hola Espanol, parlez-vous français, quack, 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 quack. That's you got to talk the same language. And I think that's where, unfortunately, we've got this term tendonitis all over the place. What does tendonitis mean? Tendonitis means inflammation of the tendon. But we talked about how this is not an acute process, right? This is an overuse problem. We showed you a picture of scar tissue. That doesn't look very inflammatory. It's like, it's just scar tissue. So we call it tendinopathy now. That just means that there's a problem in the tendon. There's pathology in the tendon. So very vague. But it's not tendonitis because it's not acute inflammation. And we got lots of different medical terms to confuse people about, okay, what's really going on with the tendon? Okay, tendinosis is that degeneration that I talked to you about, the scar tissue that forms from repetitive use. Tendinitis is acute inflammation that occurs when you use stuff, like acute cells that fix a problem are going there. That's why you get inflammation. So when you sprain your ankle and get swollen and warm, that's inflammation. So if you kind of wanted to volunteer scooping peanut butter at the local food bank and you never do that and your wrist starts getting sore and a little swollen, that's acute inflammation, or that's the tendonitis. But then you can also get peritendinitis. We have like tissues around these tendons and that can get inflamed. That happens a lot in Achilles problems. And then you can have all of them all combined because, like, it's not one discrete problem that goes on. This is like a machine. Multiple things can go wrong. And we talked about the mechanics on there. And so where do these tendon problems occur? A lot of times it's at what we call the muscle-tendon junction. That's kind of a stress area. That's where the muscle's turning into the tendon. It's a weaker junction. That kind of causes problems. And then a lot of times, it's right where it inserts into the bone. Those are the two stress points, oftentimes, that you get tendon. So if you have tendon, a tennis elbow, where does it hurt? Oftentimes, right on that bone. Where plantar fasciitis, right on the heel where it inserts. Those are common things. So I've taught you a lot about tendon problems, and I'll test you later on in the Q&A section. Three money things that you'll be able to figure out on all your friends if this is a tendon problem or a muscle tendon problem or not. Pain on direct palpation. You now know where to look, right? The insertion of the tendon or maybe the muscle tendon junction. So you can just Google whatever limb you're looking at, look at the red stuff until it turns into the tendon, just push on that location. That's, you're going to have pain with an acute tendon problem or an overuse tendon problem. Then you have reproduction of pain with resisted contraction or that eccentric loading. Think about what that muscle tendon does. Think about how it shortens when it does the concentric activity and then do the eccentric load. And it should be painful on the eccentric load. And then passive stretch. If you know how to stretch that muscle tendon unit, try to stretch it because that should hurt. And if you at least, you have to have almost a couple of these things. You're not going to run into like pain and you stretch it and you use it and it's not hurting. That's a little bit weird. You know, if you think about this, what we explained with muscle tendon units, what they do, these things should be fairly universal. And why does it take so long to heal? Because that collagen takes a long time to change, almost 100 days. So if you told your friend comes up and tells you, oh yeah, I rested from playing tennis for 2 weeks, but my elbow's still sore when I go back. What's the answer? Yeah, you got to rest longer. So like mild things, like you think about it, oh yeah, I did something too much in the garage and my elbow hurt. You probably didn't even see the doctor. You just took it easy, sore, just took it, be careful with lifting. And it took you probably a couple weeks to get better. You know, you let the area heal itself. Then maybe you did a little bit more. You had more of a problem. Like maybe, you know, lifting everything was really quite sore or something like that. It was more than just you started taking some ibuprofen. It was a pretty bad one. Like you really limited stuff. But you took around 6 weeks. And it's usually around, if it's been there for 6 weeks and they're not turning around, that's when usually people come to see me. You know, think about that overuse thing. But because that one's going to be the one that takes 6 weeks, 12 weeks, or longer. What do we end up doing in the physical therapy? Again, this I'm reiterating things, but I want to really pound that home about why this is important. First thing they do, reduce people's pain. Nobody likes exercising when things hurt. Doesn't make sense. You gotta get people's pain down. That's where the ice comes in, the gentle stretches come in. You know, if somebody just hurt themselves, now's not the time to do heavy eccentric loading on them. They're just gonna get worse. But now when the pain comes down, then you start getting into strengthening exercises. And now we're gonna introduce those eccentric loading exercises. We're gonna train that muscle tendon unit to be able to do it. And sometimes people use modalities and things like that. That's, again, for helping pain. What do you guys think now of what I've said? How many people would say use ibuprofen or an anti-inflammatory type medication? Your friend comes in, got this overuse thing, it's been 6 weeks, pretty bad, can't lift. How many people want to say use anti-inflammatories? How much it hurts? Yeah, that's fair.
Reduce swelling. Yeah, sure.
So I think those are all good comments. Like, you know, if you care about your friend, yeah, maybe if it hurts enough, you would say it. But if you think about when we talked about the pathologies, unless it's the acute inflammation one, the real tendonitis, which is not the common situation, it's not really going to do that much. Like in an acute tendonitis, you might have some swelling. For these chronic things, it's wear and tear. It's degeneration and scar that needs to just turn over and things like that. That's why people take anti-inflammatories, but sometimes their pain's still there because they never addressed all the rehab issues, all those mechanisms to not have this problem come back. So it definitely is a good pain medication. It's good if you have someone that is that sore. You're not going to get them to do exercise if your shoulder hurts so much. You got to take their pain down. So in limited time, that's appropriate. But if your friend's like, oh yeah, I've been taking anti-inflammatories for 3 months, not getting better. You think it's going to get better? No. So, and then that's where like sometimes steroid injection, that's a favorite question everyone always wants. Oh, can you just do a little steroid injection here? It'll work great for pain. It even works a little better sometimes than the oral anti-inflammatories, but again, it's just masking things short term. It's still going to come back if you don't address the mechanism. All right. So with that, I'm going to just give you guys a chance to ask a couple of questions. I'm going to keep it short because we have a lot of time at the end. But I think to reiterate, make sure you guys get this stuff to sink in. Got a question in the back.
Yes, I had a question about metacarpitis or tendons in general. The hyaline degeneration that you mentioned that comes with age and whatever, and all these things like that. Are there any other extrinsic factors that cause that, and are there any remedies, any supplements or anything that you can do to improve the flexibility of the hyaline part? The hyaline tissue.
Right.
That's shortening, thickening.
Right. Right. Well, we're going to get into the risk factor analysis, like further down. But just to be quick on the plantar fascia stuff. You know, nutrition stuff, like is a little bit tough. Everyone always is looking for something that can stop this degenerative process, because that process is called apoptosis, what we call programmed cell death. Unfortunately, our bodies are almost designed, probably if you think about human evolution, probably it'll last maybe 50, 60 years when you think about it. But we're now, with technology, able to reduce injury, get people to live longer and do more physical activities longer. And so there's definitely extrinsic ways we do it. Simple things like making sure you maintain that good muscle tendon balance. Oral medications, not anything that's like everyone should be on this stuff. Like, there are some anti-inflammatory things like fish oil that has some evidence. A lot of people take some certain vitamins for cardiovascular disease, which at the lowest level is some inflammation in the blood vessels sometimes. And so there are some things that have some benefit, but not anything that's like the fountain of youth elixir, unfortunately. Question right here.
So is icing injuries, is that something that just kind of helps out with pain, or when it comes to these types of overuse injuries, is it actually expediting recovery?
Right. So ice, if you think about it in that process, would ice help? If you cut your hand, if I ice it, would it scar faster? Would it do better? That kind of thing? Maybe not. But in an acute ankle sprain, when it's swollen, yeah, definitely. When something's hurting, does ice feel better? Definitely. But the interesting thing, like if you look at the literature, ice and heat past 72 hours, no benefit or like detriment in either case. So just like, it's something that feels good. Like if you worked out, who doesn't like sitting in the hot tub? Everyone likes the hot tub or the sauna. If your knee's kind of hurting and sore, who doesn't like having an ice pack? It numbs the area and it works better. If something's swollen though, definitely ice is good. So does it help in recovery? Just to expand on that, we started with talking about elite athletes. You know, like, what will hockey players do when there's back-to-back games? They'll actually jump into a cold tub, because that eccentric load does cause some minor inflammation. So there is some science about recovery where maybe you can use ice not to get something too inflamed. You know, ice can have some very beneficial things in the subcellular level. Think about car accidents and stuff like that. People in a coma, we start freezing them now so that the body doesn't destroy too much stuff. We almost like slow processes down. So in that way, I don't think it's widespread that we're using that stuff. But like, I think if you're like, you're going to play soccer 3 nights in a row, icing down if your knee's hurting might help with some recovery. We'll take that one.
Sievers, similar to plant health?
Yeah, Sievers is actually something that we're going to talk about, or that kind of concept, but that's a condition that looks like plantar fasciitis, but occurs in kids, and they have a growth plate right there. So it looks like plantar fasciitis, but it's actually a problem with the growth plate. Question in the back.
The eccentric drop program, you quickly drop people down with the smoke. Can you explain that?
Yeah, so like, you actually do drop people quickly, because we actually want to stop and have that eccentric load go through there. Like, again, if I just think about it this way, like, I think the biceps curl makes the most sense to people. Okay, I contract down. Now, early on, you go nice and slow. You get very strong that, like, you do a lot of activities like that with everyday life. But then when you really want to load that tendon, you'd go fast. Like, when you think about, like, bodybuilders, you know, you go to the gym, the biggest guy in the gym, he's not doing things super, super slow. He's, like, going really fast. What's he doing there? He's actually overloading. He only does it 3 times or something because he's ripping everything up. He's like overloading the system, and then he'll recover, and now he can go even bigger. That's a way to train your body to do it. So in the same way, as people start getting better, we want to get them to those fast speeds, because if you're a dancer or a basketball player or a runner, you're not going to be doing it nice and slow. You're going to be doing it fast. Is there one more question, or? We'll take this last one. What about massage? So massage is great. Who doesn't like a good massage, right? Especially if it's a muscle problem. But like, if you've had acute tendonitis or an overuse tendinosis, how many people like to massage that? Not as much, but what we do sometimes is break down the scar tissue. A lot of people do a lot of manual things, like maybe mechanically we can get that tissue more flexible. And that actually has been a fairly successful method. How well is it studied? I think it's often case-by-case dependent. There's a lot. I don't know how much evidence there is. Like for massage therapy, for example, there isn't a huge amount of evidence that, okay, all injuries need to be treated with massage. But definitely it does help the muscle skeletal system, so I think a good adjunct. Okay. Cool, guys. Good questions. Excellent. And we'll have more time at the end. Let's continue on. We started with mechanism, then we went on the location, and we're thinking what problem could be there. Now we think about the type of tissue. We just started about talking about tendon, but all of these different things can have problems. We just touched on maybe articular cartilage and growth plates. That's cartilage. Bone, what happens there? And then soft tissues. All these things, if you overload it enough and they can't recover, we can get overuse problems. So let's talk about the biggest one that probably affects, you know, everybody knows somebody with some arthritis, because as we just alluded to, you know, the human body probably wasn't designed to hang around longer than 50, 60 years. Now, what is osteoarthritis? This is the wear and tear arthritis. This is different than rheumatoid arthritis. Like sometimes you may have relatives, their hands get very gnarled and things like that. You get deformities in the hands all over on all their joints. That might be more of a medical type arthritis, like rheumatoid arthritis or something like that. But when you have wear and tear arthritis, this is just from overuse over time, where you go through the articular cartilage and then you start affecting the bone. And so how does it look histologically? You have the nice articular cartilage. This is the protective thing for the bone, end of the bone. And this is frictionless. When you're a kid, this thing's like glass, totally smooth. We haven't been able to reproduce surfaces as smooth as human articular cartilage, like talking about metals, plastics, whatever, ceramics. It's not as frictionless as our articular cartilage when you're young. But over time, unfortunately, what happens is we start to soften that cartilage. As it starts to break down, we're going to start, like, it's got a nice honey, like a structured matrix, and it starts getting soft, and then you start getting cracks in it. Then we start getting little divots in it. And then once you get all the way down, you expose the subchondral bone, and then you have problems. So this is what it looks like when you're like a young person, nice, smooth cartilage, maybe a little bit rough on the edges, but like this is the kneecap, this is the groove it sits in, very smooth surfaces. Looks fine. Now take a look at this. You see how, like, he's putting the probe, it just got buried in one of those fissures. It's all hairy looking. This doesn't look like smooth, frictionless surface, right? This is somebody with some early arthritis with even some areas that are kind of indenting in. So that's what happens. This is probably like, you know, a 40, 50-year-old. We've done some surgery to the meniscus, which is a shock absorber, which protects the joint. This is starting to break down. And this is what the bone looks like if we take a specimen when we do a total knee replacement. This person's cutting the bone out. There's no articular cartilage on this thing, right? So that's what's happening with arthritis. Arthritis didn't happen when you're 50. It happened when you're 30. And we got to think about this when we have our young athletes that tear their ligament and, okay, we're going to operate on you and we're going to get you back in, like, let's not even wait 6 months. Let's get you back in 3 months and push you to the limit. You do damage to the articular cartilage. How does that add up down the road? What happens to this young athlete when they're 50, 60? Again, arthritis is almost inevitable with bad injuries to the knee. And so at UCSF, we are studying this stuff. We're trying to get a better understanding of articular cartilage? Because, you know, right now, what's our one cure for these things? We're really just doing replacement surgery. That's really the only cure we've got. What we really want to do is we want to prevent these things from happening. So we're doing a lot of MRI type studies right now because one of our researchers in radiology has kind of found a special type of sequence that we can actually guess how much proteoglycan, that's the molecule that's a big component in articular cartilage. And so they've been able to do these things that turn the cartilage into color maps. And so the red areas where you have less proteoglycan, that means that there's more degeneration going on. And they found that patients with arthritis demonstrate abnormal signals on their MRI before they get to that point where, like, we're seeing all these fissures and bone-on-bone wear where you can just see it on an X-ray. By the time you see it on the X-ray, arthritis is already there, right? We're not going to be able to prevent it. We're just managing it from there. But that's kind of exciting stuff that you might see. Like, in the future, you might just go scan your knee and see how healthy your knee is to predict, you know, how much longer you can play soccer or something like that. You never know. And so I actually did some studies myself looking at marathon runners. So we looked at people before and after running a marathon and then at 3 months. So T2 is a special type of signal in MRIs that just shows shifts in water content. So you might imagine that if you ran a marathon, that your cartilage might get a little swollen after running 26 miles. Makes kind of sense. And the nice thing is, after 3 months, these were all people that were beginner marathon runners, so they weren't going to run another race right away. So they actually, over time, at 3 months, they went back down to kind of their baseline levels. You know, these were all different locations of the knee. Like, this is the kneecap. This is, like, part of the inside part of the knee. And so everyone went up and then went down. But this was that special sequence that we looked at, that they went up, but at 3 months, they're just starting to go down, but they're not normal yet. So this was the proteoglycan content. It hadn't recovered yet. So it's interesting research that if we're onto something here, that maybe cartilage behaves a little differently than water shifts, and we might need to wait a little longer for things to actually recover. Now, this is somebody different. Like, you know, there's guys that run marathons every weekend. You know, they might be a little different. This is a beginner marathon runner. They're not used to running all the time. They might need to adapt. But I think I don't want you to go to all your running friends now and tell them to stop running or anything like that. That's not what I'm trying to say. But I'm just saying that we have to understand cartilage a little better. And hopefully these MRIs can teach us early stage, like, how long does it take for something to recover? That might be very important. So what were the summary things from my study? That over 3 months, these T1 rho values stayed high, that something else is happening than just shifts in water. There might be some mild degeneration of some sort that's occurring here. The interesting thing was, just looking at the MRI, some people had actual divots. These are all asymptomatic runners. They had no problems. They were going to train. I remember the one time the radiologist was calling me going, like, oh, this person's running the marathon tomorrow. You got to stop this person. This person has no pain. I'm not stopping them. They have this. It's an incidental finding that people have a divot, like no cartilage in one area underneath their kneecap. And they don't always have pain. And so the kneecap and the inside part of the knee were the areas where the knee was taking the most load. So it makes sense, right? If you're running and stuff like that, you might think your kneecap probably takes a lot of the load. So it was just kind of confirm that. So you had a good question about Sievert's disease. Well, what about our young people? What are we doing with those guys? They get overuse injuries as well. And why do they get these injuries? Because we make them do what adults do. You know, if you go to any little league thing, there's a pitcher's mound, you know, the same mound that the adults use. Like, how many people go closer and let their kid throw them? No, they're like on the mound and they're trying to toss just the same distance as an adult would. So a lot of times we get kids to do what we do. Kids get tired faster. That's just, you know, they're smaller and they use energy in a different way than adults do. So they get tired. There's a lot of strength studies that if you gave a kid the same weight program, they just can't build the same muscle mass as an adult can. But a lot of times, you know, we're pushing kids pretty hard sometimes. And then there's flexibility issues. When kids are really young, They're like Gumby. They can do all kinds of stuff. They're really stretchy and stuff like that, but they're not that strong. And just like anyone else, you overload them, you overuse them, they're going to get stressed and then lead to failure. So where do these guys get failure? Rather than the tendon, which is super stretchy, right? They're super flexible, super healthy. They have really good elastic bands for their tendons. They're not going to get damaged here. Where is their weakest spot? It's actually where they're growing, the growth plate. So this is a diagram of what we call Osgood-Schlatter's disease, if you've ever heard of that. The kids are growing from this line here. That's where you have a growth plate, right on this bump in the front of your shin. And what's attaching there? You've got this patellar tendon. It's like the elastic band, and it's anchored right into that. So as kids start running a lot, you're pulling at this whole area, this insertion of the bone, which has this weaker growth plate right behind. So in a way, you create a stress fracture in these kids because they're just running too much. And what's the age that this happens? Usually kind of pre-puberty. They're 13, 14 years old. They're getting bigger. They're getting into more sports. They're running around faster, longer periods. We're training them. And they're growing. They're going through this growth spurt. So that's where you start overloading the growth plate. You mentioned Sievers disease. There it is. It happens at the heel. So it looks like plantar fasciitis, but there's really that growth plate that's going on where the Achilles and the plantar fascia are meeting right at a growth plate. But you can get it all over the place. Stress fractures in the back. I see that a lot. If you have a young athlete, if you have relatives that, you know, are in sports and they come in with back pain, like how many people know a young person who's got back pain? You do? Okay, you better send them my way then. If you don't see high school kids saying I got back pain. That's just weird. If they've got back pain for 2 weeks, especially when bending backwards and they're an athlete, the number one thing is stress fracture in the back, almost like 75%. So you definitely got to think about that. And they can get it on the pelvis. They can get it in the toes. They can get it all over the place. The good thing is they're growing. They've got a lot of capacity for their bones to remodel and everything like that. They're going to do fine in most cases. So with a little reassurance for the parents, maybe some advice on modifying activities or how much activity is right, resting these kids so that we're not sending them back too fast, they're going to do fine. So again, we rarely need to do anything surgical on these people. Here's just another example of where they have a growth plate on the patellar tendon. You got one down here, but you also have one at the end of the kneecap. So just a different location. So that's where, you know, we talked about point number two. What's the location? Oh, this is a kid. Oh, maybe they have a growth plate over there. Oh, you've got a growth plate problem. So you guys can all figure this out. Sorry? Question? This is the kneecap. This is where you get another growth plate right here. A more rare form. Most of the people have it on this side, but some people can get it on the opposite side. So what do? We call these apophysituses. The apophysis is that tendon insertion close to a growth plate. And so just resting them. These kids are turning over their bone. They're growing like weeds. This is not, they're pre-puberty most of the time. They're going to do fine with some rest. We just got to take them out of sports and maybe not take them completely out of training, because like any kid who's pretty serious, and the parents definitely are not too interested in a lot of times taking them out completely, you just find a good balance so they're not overloading and can recover. A lot of times we'll keep an athlete, especially if they're in season and they're serious, in low impact activity, riding a bike, swimming, doing things that's not going to overload them, but keeps them active, right? As long as we're not overloading them, remember that, what an overuse injury is? You just got to stay below where they can adapt and recover. And then we'll give them strengthening exercises, rehab them. You know, for a pitcher, we might do throwing kind of exercises, stuff like that, keep them active. And so, like, whether you're a little kid or a big kid, I think you can use these kind of simple things about, like, should you return back to your activity? You can apply this to work. You can apply this to your favorite sport. You know, the first question you got to ask is, like, is it safe for the person to go back? If they're going to go back to the sport and the injury is going to get worse, then that's obvious that they can't go back, right? You might need to talk to your doctor if you're not familiar with the thing. Then it's the next question is, can the athlete participate effectively? If you're a tennis player and it hurts every time you're playing tennis and you almost want to hit with your left hand, you're probably not going to play tennis very well. So, you know, you're probably not ready for that activity yet. But you'd be surprised. People limping around at Chrissy Field going for their run, you could see, like, people just try to do things to push through pain. A lot of times, if they're not effective, then maybe they're not ready for the sport. And then are you relatively pain-free? I think, like, we often have the no pain, no gain mentality, but, you know, pain's your body telling you that something's damaged. So going through it's probably not a great idea. And as a sports doc, what we're trying to do a lot of the time is not take everyone out, but we want to avoid a secondary or this becoming a chronic injury. You saw what happens to the tendon, right? If you just kept going and going and going, you're just going to get more scar tissue there. It's going to take longer for you to heal. Sometimes a lot of people wait 3 months, 6 months, a year before they come in. It takes a long time to fix these people after. Okay, we'll get back to the Olympics just so that we make sure you guys are nice and awake. The Nagano Olympics. Famous YouTube video. This is, of course, an acute problem. But of course, we're going to go slow-mo like any good sports medicine talk. Yeah, see how he lies down. And think about the mechanism. He landed right on the back of his shoulder, got caught up there. He's landing on the arm, right on the shoulder. And you see that it's kind of dislocated backwards. Very uncomfortable. All right, so let's move on now to identifying the risk factors. You've got your friend, he's told you how it happens, you get in a point where it is, okay, I got it, it's his tennis elbow, I got this. We thought about the tissue, it's a bone, nah, it's not a bone, it's probably a tendon, it's right on the tendon insertion. Well, why do you get it? How do you fix this person? What advice do you give them? And I think we go to identifying the risk factors. So to highlight this, we're going to talk about another common problem that many of you may have had. We're going to talk about stress fractures. And a gentleman asked about nutrition and how do you kind of prevent things. You know, there's obviously a way to make us better to try to prevent things, but there's a lot of factors. I think the human mind is just always very simple. We like to go, oh, yeah, it was that time I threw out the garbage like 6 months ago. That's why I got the shoulder problem. That makes sense. That's when it hurt. But, you know, who knows, right? Like, think about the factors for a stress fracture. This is something that we've known since the 90s. We're still dealing with stress fractures as a problem. Gait mechanics. Let's think about shin, like a stress fracture in the leg, like that soccer player you saw early on. Gait mechanics, how much you train, what kind of impact they are, and your bone health. Those are all things that would affect bone loading. And so, like, if you just loaded that bone over and over and over, you're going to create stress injury. Is that a bad thing? No, we talked about how that's probably happening normally when we go for a long run and your shin's a little sore. And then you give it enough time to recover, now your bone's even stronger. Then you can do more the next time. That's how you start marathon running and you end up finishing a marathon or more, as many people do. But if you get unbalanced, then you start creeping from this early stress injury where you recover down all the way to stress fracture. So this is a big laundry list. These are all the things we got to think about when I got a stress fracture on my hands. Oh, well, women get it more than men. Oh, is there foot problems again? Is there a mechanics problem at the foot that's making them load their shin too much? Flat feet, high arches. Is there a leg length discrepancy? Are they like loading the bone more on one than the other? Higher BMI. Force equals mass times acceleration, right? You guys have heard all this already. You guys can figure these things out now. Decreased bone density, and we're going to talk about that. This affects young women athletes. That could be a problem. And then we talked about muscle imbalances. Are things flexible enough? Are they strong enough? And then we talked, a gentleman brought up the question about extrinsic risk factors. We like to divide things into intrinsic, that's something inherent to the person you're dealing with. That's something that maybe changes slowly over time. Like all these things will take a few weeks to months to change, but extrinsic things are often training related. It's like, what are they doing? How much are they training? Are they wearing the right shoes? What surface are they running on? How much mileage are they doing? And they found that a risk factor for stress fracture is running over 20 miles a week. Does that mean no one can run 20 miles a week? No, not necessarily. Some people may have a problem. So that is seen to be a risk factor. And so this is kind of interesting that the stress fracture group also showed weak hip adductors. So when they kind of tried to do a single leg squat or something, they'd lose their balance because their hip strength wasn't strong enough to support their body. So remember I told you I was going to bring that back at some point. Even though we're talking about the lower leg, body strength higher up at the core is a risk factor. So that's why sometimes we give exercises in different locations. Let's talk about footwear. How many people know have read Born to Run? Anybody read that best-selling book? Again, there's this whole controversy about this, like should people be running barefoot? Or now you go to the shoe store and now like you're paying $200 for this thing that looks like a ballet slipper, you know? These are the minimal shoes. And so why are people talking about this? This is because there's a guy named Dan Lieberman. He's a famous anthropologist at Harvard, and he's been studying runners and evolution of why we became bipedal runners. And he sees that in Africa, a lot of people who didn't wear shoes, a lot of the people are running around on their midfoot or their forefoot. So he studied this biomechanically. He took a bunch of, I'm pretty sure these were Harvard runners, and then he basically, first thing, just put them in their shoes and watched how they run. And most of them were heel strikers. So when you put them on a force plate, when your heel hits the ground, you get the sudden spike of impact when your heel hits the ground. Then it goes down, and now your foot goes flat. Remember we talked about the foot flat? And the pressure even goes higher, but it's a slower curve. And then you toe off, and the pressure comes off. So that's a typical impact curve when your heel hits the ground. Now, what happens when you do a forefoot strike when you have no shoes? What's different? The gradual impact's a lot smoother, and you don't get that abrupt impact force. So you see how that's a gentler curve? So there's less impact when you're landing on your forefoot and then just toeing off. Now, what happens if that person runs barefoot but heel strikes? You get this massive impact force right there, and then you go high. So what's the worst scenario? Running barefoot with your heel strike. But that's the whole controversy. This isn't news. Like I think the book kind of highlighted it, but in sports medicine, we've been talking about this for decades, like ever since the running shoe came out and you had the waffle trainer, like that people might be cushioning their heel, so now you could actually do this. If you look back at old runners, like in the 50s and 60s, a lot of them were mid to forefoot runners. Now we got this big, nice cushioning shoe. Now we can actually heel strike without hurting ourselves, right? I'll just soften that load by putting a nice cushy heel on myself. Now I can actually do this heel strike. And that kind of got introduced in the 70s. So now you've got the swing of the pendulum back towards, well, maybe this is the more natural way to run. I think the bottom line is we don't know, unfortunately. I think it's nice trend, sells lots of shoes. It's really interesting science-wise. But, I think there's a little bit more to figure out. And is this less injurious than this scenario? Like if you're a runner and you're used to running in shoes, does that mean you need to change? If you don't get injuries and you're happy, do I need to change you? Not necessarily. So just always keep that in mind when new science comes out. But this is an interesting thing. It's something we got to study more in sports medicine, which I thought you guys would find interesting.
Did you do comparison to toe runners?
Sorry, the question was?
Comparison to toe runners?
Well, is that a comparison to toe runners? Well, these are the toe running here. So, like, these are people that the same subjects, but now they got them to run on their toes and looked at the force impact. I think in terms of the mechanics, like, if you're saying, like, were they natural toe runners and they look at
no,
that
I'm
subset?
In the comparison, you made a heel striker and some flat foot.
Oh, sorry. Well, these are four-foot strikers. Sorry, these are four-foot strikers. Yeah. These ones are particularly four-foot.
What about a sprinter?
A sprinter. Good question. So the question was, what about sprinters? If you watch a sprinter, they're always on their toe. They don't ever go on their heel. It's too slow to do that. But for long-distance running, you know, they've done interesting pictures of Olympic medal winners, and majority of them were actually heel strikers. So you would think that at that level, maybe it's better to be a midfoot or forefoot, but that wasn't the case by just looking at photos of their heel strike. But I think it's still a controversial thing. I think this is very interesting science, and you know, there are a lot of people now wearing minimal shoes or running forefoot. What we got to do is we got to study them, right, and see if there's more injuries or less injuries. A lot of times there's just different injuries. Okay, here's a test for you guys. See how well you guys have been listening. What kind of injuries would a forefoot runner get if you started running on your toes and you're not really a toe runner? Achilles, perfect, good. You guys were listening, all right. So let's keep going with these stress fractures. So failure of the bone to adapt. We knew that from point number one, right? What's the mechanism? And what happens is you actually get little micro cracks into the bone. And the crazy thing is that how does bone heal itself? When you get an injury to the bone itself, like a little crack, you're going to send cells in to take the bone away and then lay down new bone. We call them osteoclasts and osteoblasts. Blasts being the guys that lay down bone. Osteoclasts are the ones that take away bone. It just happens that osteoclasts work faster than osteoblasts. So if you're trying to heal your bone, you're actually removing bone at a higher rate. Now, that could be fine if you rest and you let the bone lay back down. But what happens if you keep running and keep running? Every day you keep running. The osteoclasts actually end up weakening the bone, and you actually get into a bad spiral where now you start getting weak through the bone, and then what happens? You saw it in that first movie with the soccer player. Then you can overload the thing, and the bone can crack right across. Then you get a real fracture. So it's always this kind of remodeling. Now we're thinking about the tissue and how bone heals. If you're down here, this is good. This is what we want. This is what's happening in all our Olympic athletes. They're training and they're remodeling and they're sore. Like go to any track team and you'll feel somebody's leg. They'll be like wincing in pain all the time. But then this is where they move into a stress reaction and then they get into a stress injury. And if we keep loading them, they'll get a stress fracture. And then if you apply enough force to them, they'll break it. So that's the spectrum. So let's jump back into stress fractures. So this is two mechanisms how stress fractures work. The compression. So this is a shin, this is the tibia, and this is the fibula. So this is the lower leg. And in this situation, you have forces that are coming together and overloading the bone. So a lot of impact activity. But the bone is actually compressing against each other. This is a fracture in the front of the shin. This is so when you run, just imagine your lower leg bending as you toe off and stuff like that, and it's bowing. And this is a traction type injury. How many of you guys would rather have the compression mechanism? How many people would rather have the traction mechanism? Nobody? Who would want neither? Okay. So basically, you guys chose the right thing. Compression is definitely desirable, right? Bone's going to heal better if it's getting pushed together. But this gets to be a very dangerous type situation because you're pulling the bone apart. The mechanism is bending the bone away from each other. So this fracture may not heal well because it's always getting pulled apart. So it's a very important thing because these can often go on to non-union. These are the type of stress fractures that we call this the dreaded black line. This is the type of fracture that might turn into that soccer player breaking his leg. And so this is some research that's from the University of Minnesota. They actually studied the college athletes. So these kids should have fairly healthy bones. And they just saw by MRI grade from 1 to 4 how bad the stress fracture is, how long do these people take? And like you might be surprised to hear that in some cases, like a bad stress fracture, it took them almost 16 weeks to heal up. But if I told you that's how long bone takes to heal, now it's not a surprise, right? But it, you know, you think about it in terms of, you know, it takes 180 days for bone to remodel. Like, even though we send them back at 4 months, they're not finished healing. They're going to keep remodeling that bone to adapt. But that's why stress fractures take a long time. So if you've had a friend or you've had one yourself, it's like, well, you know, can I go back running? I got a marathon in 2 weeks here. You know, the answer is no. Like, and just a little trick, if you do have friends and you are becoming the physician to diagnose them, like, I always go longer. Why do I do that? You know, if they get better shorter, I'm a great doc. That's right, I got better. If you ever go short and you're wrong, oh, that guy told me it was 2 weeks. What's going on here? I'm not going back there. So always go long, estimate long. You know, we do a lot of different things. There's old technology at how we used to diagnose things, like with a bone scan. That was a nuclear study. We used to be able to send tracers to where bones turning over. Now we just use MRIs. Everything's going to be MRI soon, like no radiation, and we can get really specific. So how do we treat stress fractures? You know, you guys can probably start thinking about this. These are just common sense things. Avoid stress to the bone. Get them to rest. Let the modeling process occur. You got to educate the person. How long is it going to take? And then in some cases, you immobilize them. Got to put them in a boot or a cast. Let that heal. Because bone's just really painful. If you've ever had a fracture, super, super painful. And then just be very, very worried about these non-union type situations. Or if you've got an elite, high-demand athlete who's not really going to lay off and stuff like that, you just got to be careful. Like some of these young kids, you tell them to take off 4 weeks, they're going to take 1 week off. Like you just got to anticipate that. And in some of those traction stress fractures, then we got to do surgery because you don't want that bone to break like that guy who had that ankle fracture. That athlete's going to have trouble. Like they'll end up putting a rod like this in them. But for elite athletes, a lot of times the surgeons will just go ahead and do the surgery in those traction-type mechanisms because it's more predictable. We don't want something bad happening to them. Now, who gets these kind of things? You know, a lot of the early stress fracture studies were done in the armed forces. You know, you got young, healthy recruits. We're going to put them in basic training, work them until they can't run anymore. You can imagine the number of stress fractures that we get from that. Runners, another big deal, obviously the repetitive load. And then you get other people, like jumping for ballerinas and stuff like that, all the jumping and loading. And then, you know, Yao Ming, great athlete, but he's 7 feet tall or 7'4". And, you know, he can't play anymore. He's got too many stress fractures in his feet and he's got arthritis. And so where are bad stress fractures or where do they commonly happen? The base of the fifth toe. Again, see this a lot in basketball players. There's different areas that you can get the stress fracture. And this red area is a kind of a danger zone. This is where, like a lot of people with stress fractures here, they're going to get surgery for this because this has bad blood supply. And that doesn't heal well. So that's kind of like an x-ray of what that looks like. And this is the kind of surgery that we do. We surgically fix it. So you have, this is kind of like the classic ESPN story. Oh, this famous college athlete just broke his foot, but famous Dr. So-and-so is going to do surgery, and they're back playing in 6 weeks. The only reason he could come back from a stress fracture is because we're supporting his bone. The hip's a super dangerous one. If you have running friends and they can't like hop for you, that's a danger one, because like the hip is one that if it breaks, you're in big trouble. And so that's something that, why is that a big trouble? If it breaks across, the blood supply to the head of the hip gets compromised, and then what we end up with, arthritis. That's going to be lifelong. Okay, so here I'm going to test you guys because we're at mini medical school. So this is the hip joint here. Here's the stress fracture. Is this the compression side or the tension side? How many people think compression? So I have a show of hands. I think we should almost force everyone to raise their hand. Okay, what about the tension? Is this the tension side? So actually, so if you think about here, this is like a front view of the person. So this is his left hip, the right hip's over there. If you're standing on it, the center of mass is here. Force is going to come here. So this is the compression side. This one would be the tension side. Because these two areas, gravity is pushing the bone together. If you think, if the force vectors is down, these two are coming together. Up here, it might get pulled apart. So if you ever see a stress fracture on the top side, that's dangerous. They might get surgery. The stress fracture is here. It's white. Remember I was talking about T2? T2 means water shifts. So a lot of times we look at pathology because there's a lot of swelling and things going on. So this is the stress fracture right in here. There isn't actually a crack there. You don't see actual compromise because it's still in an early phase. It hasn't actually gone to actually have a hairline crack. And so we'll finish up a little bit on the risk factor things, talking about women, because obviously, Title IX was a big deal, equal opportunity for sports in women as males. But it does have, there are differences in women's physiology compared to men, and that's around the hormone levels. And so we've learned that in young women, they can get what we call the female athlete triad. That's the triad of disordered eating, loss of periods, or what we call amenorrhea, and then thin bones, which is osteoporosis. And so like if you have a young athlete who comes in with a stress fracture, you gotta have a high suspicion, especially if they're in an endurance type sport or an aesthetic sport. You can imagine Olympics are on, figure skating, you know, people have to look good. They're it's all part of the whole picture. You're gonna spin faster if you're lighter, and you know, aesthetics count in figure skating. Hopefully not as much anymore, but it's still important. And so you can see what, like, A, these athletes are training hours and hours and hours. They may not take in enough calories. It's easy for an athlete to need more than 3,000 calories in a day. Most average people probably eat 2,000 to 2,500. But once they get into that calorie imbalance, what happens is their hormone systems don't work well. Then they actually start losing their periods. And then what happens is estrogen, which regulates your periods, has effects on bone health. So they actually lose bone health. And this is often in our younger athletes where they're at a critical growth phase. This is like, you know, teenage athlete, they're a cross-country runner, you know, maybe they're not eating enough, they get a few stress fractures, maybe their period starts like when they're 17, 18 years old as opposed to like 12, 13 years old, and then they lose a lot of years for bone density. Almost 90% of your bone mass, it actually occurs before the age of 18. So when you think about all the new drugs that were treating osteoporosis, you know, this is not a problem when you're older. It happened when you're below 20. So, you know, just keep that in mind. It can be very dangerous. And so some of the warning signs that you kind of get worried about, if a young person has irregular periods or they haven't had a period before 16, recurrent stress fractures, again, is a major thing that we see in our athletes. Being a vegetarian or having food restrictions at a young age for no good reason. You know, a lot of times they're thinking about their nutrition. They're worried about it. Or they don't like eating with other people. A lot of times, like, they train too much. They think they're overweight. Those are subtle signs that, you know, and this is fairly rampant. There's studies showing that 70% of high school women and college women don't like the way they look, even if they're normal body mass. So it's quite concerning. And so how we check it out, we got to check their hormone levels. We might check for osteoporosis. And then we talk about their diet. You know, we talked about little things like going back to some of the risk factors. Don't forget about simple things like your vitamin D and calcium intake. It's very important. There's actually a lot of research going into high-dose vitamin D. You might have heard about like super doses of vitamin D to try to correct it, and that we're in buildings too much and we're not getting enough sunlight, and our, you know, it's contributing to osteoporosis. Just you know, think about that. A lot of people are lactose intolerant. They've given up drinking milk and things like that. A lot of these new food allergies, you still need vitamin D and calcium. Sometimes we try to regulate the periods. A lot of times in these young athletes, again, there's mood issues and stuff like that as well. It's a lot of pressure to be training a lot. They're isolated. They're doing things. Maybe they're not really happy with their sport or what's going on. All those kind of things are all part of treating a young athlete with female athlete triad. And we almost need a whole team that includes the family and dietitians and psychologists, sports psychologists, and their doctors, OBGYN, all kinds of things. Just because, you know, it's a complex problem. So let's go back to stress fractures then. How do we manage it? Again, we've kind of gone over common sense type things, and this goes into the education of things. Activity modifications, what can you do? We've talked about it. It's the same kind of principles, right? We talked about it for tendon, talked about it for arthritis, swimming, non-weight-bearing activities, biking, sports-specific drills. We got to strengthen that person, do some rehab specifically for stress fractures. Sometimes a brace. Some compression onto the bone that's affected can be helpful. We sometimes even use ultrasound or bone stimulators to kind of get bones to heal up faster. Like you may know that bone has electrical kind of polar ends and things like that, that by sending electrical impulses, we can get bone and stimulate it to heal better. And then manage the expectations. You might be telling them it's going to be 3 months or 6 months or whatever it might be for them to get better. For this person, it's a tough, challenging case. Like, you got to convince this athlete to buy into what you want to do. Because what do they want to do? They just want to compete and do what they do. But in a way, like a lot of overuse injuries, it's causing the problems. So again, we got to have a comprehensive, holistic approach to solving this problem. So with that, I'm going to kind of repeat the approach to the overuse injuries that hopefully you can take home and diagnose your family and friends, start your own business, be good. Think about the mechanism of injuries. We're all going to get these things. What's the location? Get them to a point where it hurts. Think about the type of tissue that might get damaged in the location. Think about the risk factors. And at the end, common sense education. Get them to modify their activities. Give them time to recover. Again, the key features of an overuse problem, that repetitive loading. Just get them out of the cycle. That's going to help. It doesn't have to be a big injury. It's that overwhelming of the tissue. Maybe they can do something easier. You don't have to run up the hills of San Francisco. Go to a flat ground and just jog a little slower, right? Force equals mass times acceleration. And work on the imbalance. Rehab's so important here. Because the good news about a lot of these overuse injuries, they're often preventable. So thank you very much for your attention. I'd be happy to take some questions. Question? So the question was around use of ultrasound that maybe for musculoskeletal problems, does that help? Ultrasound is using sound waves, and at certain frequencies, you can actually get it to penetrate deep through tissues. So you can get them down fairly deep and generate some heat. And as we kind of talked about, ice can be useful in some cases. Heat can improve blood flow, maybe get rid of some metabolites that shouldn't be there, and can help with pain. Just like, again, we said, like heating pad might make somebody feel better. So I think there's a lot of beneficial things that ultrasound might do. It might even help with bone healing in certain applications. But the interesting thing is, if I wanted to give you the research studies, there's not a lot of literature showing that ultrasound works. Not a lot of clear studies showing that you got ultrasound and ultrasound was the thing that made these injuries get better. I think it's really an adjunct. You'll run into, just because your therapist doesn't use ultrasound doesn't mean they're a bad therapist. I think sometimes it's a danger when you're just doing ultrasound and that's all you're doing. If you go to get some treatment and all they're giving you is ultrasound, that's a little concerning because for all the reasons we talked about, you got to rehab the person. So I think, you know, the bottom line, does ultrasound work? I can't say that there's strong evidence that it does. Is it a useful adjunct for getting people to do things? Yeah, I think so. Question in the back? What about STIM? Now, the question is about electrical stimulation. That's using these pads that can actually put small electrodes to make muscles fire. And electrical stimulation does have better evidence on that, but it's just triggering your body externally to make the muscles fire. So good for building up muscles. And then sometimes at low doses, again, it can reduce pain and generate some heat in the muscle deep. Right there. Okay, the question was, what about synthetic cartilage in osteoarthritis? I think, you know, we're all trying to move toward getting a cartilage replacement so we can kind of get to people before they get arthritic. We can fill small defects with stem cells, but we can't really cover a whole joint yet. And so maybe the last question right here. So the question is, does a Baker cyst fall under the situation of overuse? Well, a Baker cyst is oftentimes a result of degenerate changes, often arthritis or a degenerative meniscus tear. And what it does is it creates a one-way valve in the back of the knee, and fluid actually can get pushed out as you bend, and then it gets trapped because it's like a one-way valve. And so it collects in the back of your knee, and a lot of times when people are at rest or sleeping, the fluid slowly leaks back in the knee, and then it decompresses a little bit. So in a way, it could be. If arthritis or osteoarthritis is considered an overuse problem for the most part, yeah, it's a degenerative problem. But it may not be a training problem or you're doing something wrong. It could just be bad luck. All right. Well, stay safe, guys. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.